Hello, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Media Voices, the media-focused podcast that brings you all the news and the views from around the media world. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
And there are less than 2 weeks to go to get your entries in for the Publisher Podcast Awards. You can go to publisherpodcastawards.com to download your entry pack, see categories, judges and more.
Do it.
I'm really excited about it.
Yeah. No, it's going to be fantastic. So this week I spoke to Helen Pearson, the chief magazine editor for Nature. So on the anniversary of the Science Journal's 150th anniversary, we talked about what consumer-focused publications can learn about community and community building from the journal's focus on supporting scientists, the changing expectations of younger audiences, and the challenge of making research open to everybody while also supporting the authors and the journalists. But ahead of that, as ever, we're going to start with the news roundup. And Esther, why don't you take us through this first one? Because...
Why, because this blew my tiny little mind.
Exactly.
So Hearst Esquire has built a $17.99 micro-membership program around one of its politics writers. So this is the US version of Esquire. It's an annual membership program. It's not $17.99 a month. And it's around their politics writer, Charles Pierce, who's written for the magazine since 1997. So if you pay this micro-membership fee, you get access to all of his stories, a weekly newsletter written by him, and a tote bag, according to Digiday.
There you go. Tote bags for the win.
It just baffles me that you would take the risk of building a membership program completely around one of your writers. I mean, I get it's obviously quite long term, but...
Well, there's totally no risk. There's no risk.
He's right, there's no risk. But, I mean, look at those stats. I mean, they kind of speak for themselves. It's 60,000 people a day reading it.
That's just his content.
Yeah. Imagine, I was thinking about this, imagine how validated you would feel if you were Charles Pierce and Hearst came to you and said, we want you to be a brand. Yeah. It would just be the best feeling in the world as a writer.
But is there not going to be that in the back of his mind? I don't know how much of this he gets, whether he's just...
Well, see, that's the point. What's the deal?
Is that if he goes solo, he gets to keep all of that. And yes, you've not got the reach of Esquire, but if those people are seeking out his stories in particular, he could take that completely himself. I mean, you know, we look at people like Stratechery, even Baked, these people that have built businesses around their own brand. Would you...
Well, there's a couple of things going on there. One, if he's been writing for Esquire for over 20 years, he clearly loves writing for Esquire.
Yeah.
So he's invested in the brand. But also, you know, that risk would be his. That's the point of this. There is no risk anyway. He's getting paid. They haven't said, oh, we're not going to pay you anymore. We're going to put you on a percentage deal. What they've said is, we'll pay you, but we'll also put you on a percentage deal. So he wins.
Yeah.
So I think with people like Stratechery and even, you know, a friend of the podcast, Thomas Bechdel, there's more of an information aspect to it. You know, that it's, whereas politics is one of those things that kind of does have to exist under an umbrella brand.
I mean, I do agree. I don't know which one you put it in the notes, but there's an opportunistic aspect to this. They've looked at these numbers and gone, holy shit, there's 60,000 people reading this guy's stuff every day. Let's get on that. Well done, Esquire, for that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, they're now looking at things like, I think they've called it interactive integrations, conference calls where you can talk directly to him, or my favourite one was listening in to Pierce and his editor reviewing political events.
Well, that's kind of weird.
That is very strange.
Now, do you reckon we could get away with charging people to listen to us?
To bring this back across the pond, there's a few things here that I thought were particularly interesting. One is that a couple of years ago, I remember UK newspapers were afraid that their key writers would decamp and start their own brand under their own name. Didn't really seem to happen, but I seem to remember they were deprioritising people's bylines and hiding people's social so that they didn't really happen.
But I mean, there are UK journalists that have done that. There are UK journalists that have left quite major newspapers and basically started up their own Patreons and almost membership schemes.
You know, I can only think of the ones that have failed.
I can't actually think of a successful one.
I was just going to say that.
I think this New Statesman's done something like this with Stephen Bush.
So let's have a little thought experiment.
Right.
Who would you pay $17.99 a year to read their stuff?
Marina Hyde.
Yeah, that's who I was going to say.
I mean, I think it's quite a nice accessible price point. There's no Esquire digital subscription at the moment, so it's not like you're paying out twice. That's 15 quid in UK terms. That's nothing for an annual subscription. And I think that there are plenty of people, it just depends on your political bent for this kind of thing.
Yeah. I think that's the point. Everyone has a writer, a publication that they would favour it and they would consider paying that kind of money.
Do you reckon we could each launch our own micro brand under Media Voices and people would pay to only hear our sections of the audio every week?
We could do that quite easily. We could just strip the journals out. Oh, that's a business model. You get one channel for free. You get two for a fiver a month. And you get all three for a tenner a month.
This is genius.
Wow.
That's a business model.
Launching next week. Oh, talking of launches, it's Cool Britannia all over again as BritBox launches in the UK. Remember the Spice Girls? So,
tell me BritBox, what you want, what you really, really want.
So BritBox, the Netflix for the UK, which is, you know, put together by ITV and the BBC, is launching in the UK this week. It's been going in the US for, I think, a year now. But this week it's been bolstered through major deals with BT, Channel 4 and EE.
How come the US get a BritBox first?
Well, because it's a stronger selling point. Okay, so here's the fundamental flaw with this product. You can get all this shit in Britain on 4OD and Sky and
Dave.
iPlayer and whatever.
Yeah, Dave must be quaking in their boots if BritBox is going to be taking back their content. You know, part of the selling point, I was reading the interview with Tony Hall in the Radio Times, is that they will be pulling back their content that currently appears on Netflix.
Oh, do you know, that should be a slogan on a banner, take back content!
But yeah,
Nexit!
Stop Nexit!
Stop Nexit!
Or Box It, but that sounds like a removal firm.
So in the words of the senior Digiday correspondent Lara O'Reilly, I cannot be convinced that BritBox will work, which I wholeheartedly...
Why not?
Well, I wholeheartedly agree with her statement. This doesn't seem to make sense, in the UK at least, because there is little exclusive content on there. There are two previously unaired episodes of Midsummer Murders, which are going to be on there.
Well, that might convince half the country to sign up.
Yeah. That'll convince people to pay £6 a month for this. And as Peter said, that's just potentially having access to all this is a strong sell outside the UK. Potentially the kind of the wealthy expats in Hong Kong or wherever are jonesing for this content in the same way that they sort of jones for, I don't know, hobnobs. But the amount that ITV and the BBC have set aside for creating originals, you know, the thing that attracts people to a service, is paltry. So last year, rather 2018, Netflix spent $12 billion on content and over $2 billion on marketing.
Can I play the other side of this? That I actually think this is a long-term play.
Mm.
Because, okay, so BritBox is not going to win the streaming wars in the short term. You know, we've got Disney Plus launching, I think they've said, March next year in the UK. Amazon, Netflix, Apple, they're all going really, really heavy into original content. The BBC is struggling. I think there was a report out a couple of weeks ago that Ofcom were like, yeah, you guys are actually heading for serious trouble.
Yeah.
And at first I kind of looked at this and I was like, well, isn't this just going to completely cannibalise this? So, you know, if you've got your monthly licence fee, why would you pay £12 a month for your licence when you could just pay £5.99 a month for this? But I think they're looking towards that future where people don't pay for the TV licence anymore. And actually instead that this is then something they could use, because the technical, they could never get like a licence fee login thing. There's huge technical reasons why not. So this is actually something where they could say, this will almost be like the way the license fee works in the future.
Yeah, the report you're talking about there, they basically said that young people recognise Netflix like way more readily than they recognise iPlayer even.
But that's because the way that the license fee and the way that you pay for the content on the BBC, it just doesn't compute to anybody under 40.
Peter, what is your take on this then? Because you gave a sort of sigh during that, which made me think that you have some thoughts.
If I was being brutally honest, I think the license fee should just come out of general taxation and we should stop f***ing around. Because the BBC, whether you like it or not, is as much of a national treasure as the NHS in this country. Look at the shit show of broadcasting in America as a comparison.
Well said.
But I understand the distribution, and I think the point Esther's just made about, you know, replacing the license fee is valid. You know, there's a lot of logic in that. But I worry maybe ITV, BBC and Channel 4 should just focus on making content and distributing it and licensing it everywhere, because that's what they do best.
well, just to the license fee point, they would never recoup what they would lose, you know, from the license fee through this with the, no, what with the rev share absolutely. And that low price absolutely. Point.
But it does depend if they can capture that lower end of the market. I mean, I think they've got bigger issues in this anyway, in that most of the stuff they've got on there is probably most people of the target market have it on box sets of DVD or video.
All VHS, yeah.
Or gold.
But there's also been a bit of a row this week because they're keeping some of the inappropriate classic UK TV shows off the service, basically ones that were racist. I don't know. It's a bit tricky.
Do you two remember Heil Honey, I'm Home?
What?
So it was a sitcom. They filmed 6 episodes, but they only aired the pilot, which was Eva Braun and Adolf Hitler living in the suburbs next to a Jewish couple. But it went so far over the line that they basically went, you know what, let's maybe not air all 6 episodes.
No, I mean, there's 2 that aren't appearing. It's, I think, Death Do Us Part and then ITV's Love Thy Neighbour, which were
those shows as a historical artefact are interesting, but would you really want to watch the full run of Alf Garnett banging on about whatever?
Yeah, maybe, but is this to capture? Okay, so is this just then to capture the olds? You know, I don't know that these uncinematic, kind of relatively low budget sitcoms will attract younger audiences now. They're used to that, you know, incredible spend on content that you get from Netflix. They're used to these kind of cinematic, ongoing comedy storylines that you got from like BoJack Horseman or Good Place or whatever.
You're saying that, but Friends is the most popular thing anywhere ever. Yeah, I think people watch comedy nostalgically.
Maybe this is just additive revenue for them. They said, you know.
Yeah, and the quote on this was that they wanted to be profitable. They didn't want to have £30 billion worth of debt dollars worth of debt that, like Netflix did.
You know what? Well, that's
fair enough. I think the market is too hot to try and compete with the global giants on this at the moment. So they'll wait for them to blow themselves out and then be sitting there nicely with Fawlty Towers. Okay, and now for the news in brief. 2 big passions of mine intersected this week in a very baffling launch. Smash Hits magazine returned for one night only with new West End musical And Juliet. If the connection's lost on anybody else, it's because the And Juliet musical soundtrack is 90s inspired. So there you go.
Did you make this story up? Because this is too perfectly in the centre of your Venn diagram of interest.
No.
Oh. But this one's interesting in light of the other one-off returns we've seen. You remember when the NME came back?
Yeah. There's this quote. It's like, magazines have the power to deliver high quality attention at exceptional value for advertisers. Yeah, but what? Only for one-off specials?
One-off specials that reprint all the content from the 90s?
Yeah, it's a weird one.
Very strange. Moving on. The Global Editors Network, the group who put together the Gen Summit, which I've attended a couple of in the past, and they've been fantastic, they made the shock announcement that they're closing this week after 9 years. They cited a lack of sustainable finances as the main reason, which Matthew Ingram pointed out is just too obvious a metaphor.
Yeah, the irony in that one is not. Twitter is rolling out topics, meaning you shall be able to follow topics like you currently follow accounts. I guess that's very similar to Instagram's hashtags. It started with more than 300 topics across sports, gaming and entertainment. I can hardly wait to get sorted with topics on Twitter.
Geo Media's editorial director Paul Maidment has left the company less than a week after the entire editorial staff of Deadspin resigned. He was the one responsible for telling them to stick to sports.
Did you see this piece in the New Republic?
Yeah, it was fantastic.
It was really good. Hey, we all read it.
Piece, the death of the Rude Press. I mean, it's not just about Deadspin falling apart, but it's just brilliant.
It's a genuinely thought-provoking piece, that. And some good print news. So 4 titles have seen growth this quarter at Meredith, and the portfolio-wide newsstand revenue has also increased.
Oh, why come I end up with this one? Court documents have shown Facebook deliberately cut off access to user data for app developers. This story is awful.
It is, yeah. Well, I'm just confused, because with the rebrand, I can't tell, you know, which Facebook is Facebook the company and which Facebook is Facebook the social network. It's complete mania.
Facebook all caps. Facebook all case.
Talking of looking after your privacy, our other favourite global tech giant, Google, is in discussions about changing its political ad policy just a week after Facebook and Twitter have kind of staked their ground. It's not yet clear which side they're going to fall on, but they would have to implement this policy change across all their platforms, including YouTube.
I reckon they'll probably fall on the side that makes them money. And McClatchy have launched a new subscription product called Impact 2020, which will give users access to all the political reporting from its 30-plus local papers, as well as national election news.
I think that's a really smart idea.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if Johnson Press like still had a business or whatever, they could have done something like that.
JPI Media, now. Get with the times.
Oh, yeah.
So this week I spoke to Helen Pearson, who's the chief magazine editor for Nature. On the anniversary of the Science Journal's 150th anniversary, we talked about what consumer-focused publications can learn about community building from the journal's focus on supporting scientists, the changing expectations of younger audiences around things like video content and audio, and the challenge of making research open access while also supporting authors and journalists. But I began by asking her to explain what they're doing to celebrate the 150th anniversary.
Nature is, if I can immodestly say, one of the world's leading science journals, and that means that we publish peer-reviewed research from scientists. So we try and publish some of the most significant and fundamental advances in all areas of research, from quantum physics to climate change to molecular biology. And then Nature's also quite unusual, and there were also a news magazine for scientists. So we have the peer-reviewed research, but we also have what we sometimes call the front half of the journal, which is effectively like an economist for scientists, and that we have news and opinion and editorials and all that type of material aiming to inform working scientists in the scientific world about what's happening in science. The core audience is very much working scientists. So when I'm commissioning pieces, that's who I'm thinking about. But we find today online that we attract a much, you know, bigger audience than that, a halo audience of people who are just interested in science. So we want to be kind of the authoritative word on anything to do with science. So I was a reporter for a while. I actually had the opportunity to go to New York. I was there for 8 years for Nature, which was really great in terms of learning about different, you know, science policy and the landscape in a different country is really important, because we are an international journal. That's really important to us. And then progressed to become an editor. So I ran the features team for Nature for a while, really grew to kind of love more long form writing, you know, kind of the combination of like the sort of deep nerd, if I can say that, you know.
I'm sure
details.
The writers won't mind. Yeah.
Well, that's no, fine. We're proud of it. You know, we say we're sort of boldly nerdy and proudly geeky, because that's who we're writing for. That is who we all are. You know, we love science, and so we revel in that.
This must be one of the few roles, science journalist must be one of the few roles that is still very specialised and isn't kind of the generalist news writer that you see across a lot of the newspapers.
Yeah, I mean, science journalism positions across a lot of publications are ones that have been cut over the last, you know, decade or so, as there have been cuts, you know, across the media industry. And so we're incredibly fortunate at Nature to have still an entire team. I mean, I've got about 15 journalists around the world who are all focused on reporting about science. So we're very, very fortunate to have that and to be so specialised. You know, and our reporters are so specialised that, you know, they're going to be focused on climate change or something, you know, even within that. But you need that if you're going to write authoritatively about these very complex fields.
Mm. So we've touched upon, in fact, I think we've effectively answered one of the questions that I sent across, which is, you know, what are the core values of Nature that have remained the same? And it seems that kind of inquiring spirit and a lot of the authority that you want to put into your reporting is still there. But we also touched upon the fact that the focus has gone from print to digital. So has there been a sea change in how you actually present that authoritative journalism online?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I suppose from where I'm sitting, have we fundamentally changed what we do and how we approach authority, you know, in digital versus print? I mean, not when you're talking about a story, because ultimately, if you've got a piece of journalism, you know, it has to be right and it has to be, you know, accurate and fact-checked and all of those things, whether you're putting it into print or digital. So at least if you're talking about written content, you know, the text is the same. You know, we're fortunate to have this kind of Nature brand, which comes with a certain amount of respect and authority, at least within the scientific communities. And that's very important to us. I suppose it's more that now we're sort of swimming through a different sea, right? So the question more is, how do we ensure that that actually reaches people who might, you know, need to know it, or we think they need to know it, amongst a sort of growing, you know, tidal wave of information, and now, you know, misinformation and disinformation. So that is a challenge, and I can't pretend that we have, you know, the answers to all of that.
Yeah.
Apart from, we are going to continue to get it right.
Are you, well, recently, talking of changes, there was that sort of redesign of kind of Nature branding, and there's a fascinating essay that we'll share in the newsletter about how the sort of the branding and how Nature presents itself has changed. So going more digital, how are print and digital working together, and how is there a sort of a how are you ensuring that there's continuity of kind of that brand recognition, but also that there's enough, I said, agility within both sides to make it work?
Yeah, I mean nowadays, compared to what I was talking about earlier, you know, print and digital in my team is absolutely works hand in hand. I mean, there's no different teams. We're all just, you know, one team, and my challenge has just been to changed, you know, we still have to produce this printed magazine. Some, you know, subscribers really love it. So we have to spend some effort on that. But what we're trying to do is sort of spend less effort on the print product, and then just ensure that all of our efforts are going into digital, and we just flow stuff smoothly into print, because we know we reach so many more people,
yeah,
you know, in digital than we do in print. So it's trying to balance the kind of workload and effort with where we know our readers are. And so the redesign that we just did, which was first time we've redesigned our print issue in 10 years, was actually a really kind of exciting opportunity, not just to kind of update how we look, but also to address some of these practical problems with allowing that flow from digital to print to happen. And so, you know, a really small example, I mean, I've got a copy in front of me, but is allowing some of the stories, you know, I mean, this must be common amongst so many magazines, but having to get things to fit on the page, yeah, right? You know, carefully cutting lines and making sure it all looks perfect. And then in some of our news spreads after the redesign, we just said, we don't have to make things fit. We can sort of, you know, when you've got a selection of little articles, you just let them run ragged at the ends,
yeah,
which just, again, just eases that whole flow of the entire team of just running stuff, you know, through to print in that way. And you also had asked me before about whether we have sort of digital only,
yeah,
products. So yes, I mean, not all of our stuff goes into print anymore. So it's much more about just, you know, publishing the best we can in digital. And certainly in our news, we're definitely just now selecting the pieces that we think would make a nice package in print, and sort of flowing those in.
So how much, you know, back and forth is there with the audience, in terms of, you know, finding out what they would like, what they would like to see more of in editorial, even new editorial products?
Yeah, lots. I mean, of course, we want to hear about that. And before we did this most recent redesign, we did some quite extensive market research to,
yeah,
you know, find out what the pain points for people were and how we could improve that. And so in print, one thing we learned, I mean, interestingly, in print, we know that the demographic is very different than it is online.
Yeah.
So something like, I think it might be as much as over a half of our readers were in print and now over 55.
Yeah.
And then online, it's completely the other way around. So we've got a, you know, the vast majority are in the younger age groups. And one feedback we had was that actually the text we were printing in was just too small for a lot,
yeah,
of people to read. One of the really exciting things we did in our redesign was we've now got a custom font that we commissioned called Harding, which is basically kind of tooled to be very easy to read both in digital and also in print. And we've actually had feedback from people saying, I couldn't read the print copy for like 8 years and now I can read it again, which of, wow, course is very rewarding.
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that the Telegraph should probably look into as well.
Right.
The younger demographic that's in digital, what sort of editorial products are they looking for? Are they looking to, you know, see more video? Are they looking for more audio content?
Yeah, all of those. I mean, it's a big thing. I don't have all the answers, of course.
Yeah.
I wish I did. It's something I think about a lot, because I think it's very, very important for Nature in particular, which has this particular, you know, sort of reputation and can potentially sound a little bit elitist, that we are absolutely reaching younger readers and the scientists of the future. And we try to publish pieces which also speak to their career stage. So we know, for example, that anything we write about people doing PhDs is very popular. The challenges of people facing around mental health in postgraduate studies, you know, unfortunate things around harassment and the struggles which people have in those early stages of scientific career is often quite popular with our audience. Does it also build value beyond that? Definitely.
Yeah.
So there's a hole now, but because of the success of Nature, the company was able to launch an entire range of what we call Nature branded journals. Yeah. So there's about 50 of them now. So we have Nature Medicine and Nature Biotechnology and Nature Immunology and you know, and on and on and on. And so, you know, it's only really because of what Nature has been able to achieve and the reputation that we establish, you know, helps us to also encourage people to read these other products as well. And even beyond that, you know, the bigger company we're part of, which is Springer Nature, publishes over 3,000 journals.
Yeah.
So everything which we do, and we're effectively seen as the flagship kind of product, all helps to sort of build the reputation, you know, which will hopefully encourage people to also read beyond Nature itself.
It's a real rising tide floats all boats situation then across the portfolio.
Yes, we like to argue that, especially when we're looking for resources to do, you know, new exciting things.
Yeah, well, you did mention that before, you know, the idea that with a legacy company does come some slight drag, particularly if you want to launch new products. Is that something you've had to grapple with?
Sometimes, yes. Yeah. You know, that's common across any large organization. Yeah, if you want to do something new, you've got to, you know, argue for resources and show what impact it will have. You know, that's just the way that the businesses operate. Mm-hmm. But one completely digital only product we've launched, like many organizations, we wanted to launch a newsletter, which we did about 3 or 4 years ago, but that's become a really big focus for us. So we have a thing called Nature Briefing, which is a kind of, it's a curated selection, not just of what we're publishing, but what's going on across science news. So we'll draw in, you know, pieces from all different types of outlets into a daily digest. The idea being it's a kind of, you know, you read this email and you know everything you need to know about science today. And that's been, we've really, really pushed that. And that's been very, very popular and is growing quickly. And so that's a very specific way that we're trying to reach people who may never see a copy of Nature, but nevertheless are, you know, want to establish this kind of personal relationship with readers. It has a slightly more informal tone to it as well than we would have in Nature itself.
I mean, it's very similar to what a lot of other publications are doing, you know, across the B2B, B2C, you know, news spectrum.
Yeah.
Do you think it's almost just parallel evolution and that's what people, you know, audiences expect now? And it's not necessarily that, you know, newspapers will do newsletters better. It's that audiences want that kind of digest edition of whichever content they're consuming.
Well, I mean, certainly, you know, feedback we get from our readers, you know, especially academics, is that sense of information overwhelm, right? Mm. I mean, that really reflects as well science itself. I mean, the science enterprise is huge. There are so many more journals than there were even, you know, 10 years ago or 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So everybody, in my view anyway, everybody's looking for ways to find authoritative sources which will synthesize the information for you and help you deal with that. So I think we're thinking about that a lot. And, you know, that was kind of how we got to Nature Briefing. Mm. And that's, you know, I'm thinking about that a lot going forward. And we think about, you know, how do we innovate? Well, we can't just throw more content at people. We've got to help them with the problems that they have. Yeah. And if they haven't got time, how can I produce something new which would help them with that problem, right?
Yeah, certainly. And in fact, to that point, The Guardian just down the road has just recently stopped publishing quite so much, or rather quite so many articles, because they found that people were getting overwhelmed.
Exactly.
Even when they were going to the desktop site.
Yeah. Everybody does.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on.
No.
At any point.
No, and for academics, they have to keep up with their fields, you know, in order to pursue their work successfully. So, you know, that's something that we want to help them with.
We touched upon the sort of careers articles that you publish, and particularly in the front half of the journal and the magazine. Is that in service of building a community, or is that something that has always existed within Nature?
I mean, specifically, we've had career articles for a long, long time. We are very focused on kind of serving the scientific community, I would say, because ultimately a lot of what Nature publishes, I mean, you know, what we're known for is actually publishing the work of scientists. We are just providing a service for them to be able to publish their work. So we think about the community all the time. And we also find that when we, you know, when we're doing news, for example, that actually the more we sort of get inside the community and talk about what the community cares about, of course, those are the stories which are popular, you know, whether it's around, you know, I mean, sometimes it's not so good. It's around, you know, scientific misconduct, but it might be about the community wrestling with problems of reproducibility, which is challenges around, you know, ensuring that a piece of research can be reproduced by another lab.
Yeah,
but almost the more, you know, the more we go inside the community, then the more we find that the community responds and wants to read read about that, which I'm sure is the same in any industry, really.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, that a lot of publications now are turning more towards, you know, what people are calling solutions journalism, which is actually focusing on the problems of the community and attempting to fix them.
Yeah.
Which it sounds like Nature was doing that already. It sounds like that was just something that you were doing because of your audience.
Yeah, I mean, it's always really been part of our mission to, you know, not just, I've said this times before, but we're not just a passive conduit for science.
Yeah.
You know, we actually, it's very important to us that we think about the kind of ethical issues and safety issues and impact on society that science has. And so we've always been a champion for science and also kind of holding science to account and also trying to think about those impacts and discuss those impacts. And I think that that's actually kind of more important than ever before, as we see, you know, so many scientific, you know, results having impacts in society.
Yeah, certainly. I suppose that the question then for our audience is, are there any lessons from Nature, which is a very specialised publication with a very sort of intelligent and educated audience? Are there any lessons about serving a community that are applicable across the entire, you know, publishing spectrum?
Well, I think many of the issues that we wrestle with at Nature are no different, really, than any other publication. And you know, one is around diversity. So if you look back at the original, you know, copies of Nature in 1869 and the authors, effectively we were publishing, you know, mostly the work of upper class Victorian men, because that's the way it was, you know, and needless to say, and often it would just be one person writing these pieces as well.
Yeah.
And then you look at what we're publishing today, and it's obviously very different. In fact, even in our mission statement, back at the beginning, we spoke of men of science. That's how people were referred to, which we've now changed, and it says scientists. So how we better kind of, you know, include underrepresented communities in science, you know, in the issues they face, and also who we feature in our pages is really important. You know, and that conversation is happening, you know, across all types of industries and across different outlets. I suppose it comes back to what I was saying, is that I think we do the best when we just speak directly to our community and what they care about.
Yeah.
So it's almost like the more sort of deep nerd we go, the better it is, actually. And sometimes, you know, we just allow other, if we want, so rather than just focusing just on growing the audience, it's actually writing about what we think really matters.
Yeah.
I guess that's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
for the people for the scientific community, that we find, you know, kind of brings in other readers. So I guess it's just being true, isn't it, to your editorial values and what you stand for.
Yes. Yeah,
and also standing up, you know, for accuracy. I mean, I like to think that we're kind of the antithesis of fake news. You know, I talked about how we have to get it right, but we have to get it right. We're going to keep on getting it right. It's expensive to make sure you get it right, because you have editors and copy, you know, and sub-editors and everybody checking this stuff. But if we don't continue to do that, then, you know, why are we
Yeah,
here?
Exactly. Where's,
so I think it's being, yeah, exactly. It's being true to accuracy and, you know, evidence, which is ultimately what we publish.
Yeah, it's when you were talking about, you know, the change there from being men of science and how, you know, 150 years ago it was completely different. I was just in my head trying to create this through line of continuity between what Nature must have been then and what it is now.
Yeah.
It's just a completely different world. The fact that it's lasted 150 years through all these changes is phenomenal. So how are you marking that editorially? How are you celebrating these 150 years?
Yeah, I mean, enormous changes.
Yeah.
But also some of it still exactly the same. I mean, back then we were championing science and, you know, publishing amazing discoveries, and we're still doing that. So
yeah.
Some things are kind of actually exactly the same.
Yeah.
But yeah, how are we marking that celebration? I mean, we haven't. Well, one thing we did is we've literally just, you know, spent a year working on this special anniversary issue, which came out yesterday, nice. Which we're very, very excited about. And it's been a kind of joy for some of us to actually look back at this incredible archive of papers and discoveries we have, you know, these seminal discoveries. I mean, we published the structure of DNA in 1953. The double helix has become an icon of science. We pulled out a few from our archive that we're really proud of, you know, the first identification of the ozone hole above the Antarctic was another that we identified. So that's been just really sort of important to kind of recognise, you know, the significant discoveries that were published and how they've had an impact on the world, which is kind of something to be really proud of. And we also, you know, thought about what we want to do in the future. And we've got an amazing graphic on our cover where we asked some data scientists to basically take... Well, what they did in the end was they basically did a data analysis of our entire archive.
Yeah.
So what we represented in the end was this massive web of 88,000 Nature papers.
I was going to say, that's a huge...
It's a huge number. I know, and there's this incredible interactive online where you can literally zoom in on one paper and see all the other papers which have basically either were referenced in that paper or have later papers which have gone on to cite that target paper. And effectively, that shows you kind of all the different disciplines which one publication... drew on, and all the future publications that it went on to influence. So it's just this amazing way of viewing the sort of interconnected nature of science, which we're quite excited about.
Yeah, certainly that's an amazing testament to the how influential the journal's been.
Yeah, and also just shows, you know, so the colours, basically, the way we've represented it are the different disciplines, and it just shows how incredibly interdisciplinary science is. You know, it's not like the biology happens in one sphere and the physics happens in another.
Yeah.
These things are completely connected now, which is so amazing. I mean, it's still, as I said, because of our sort of business model, it's still making sure that we are offering these institutional subscribers what they want. And so a massive challenge for us at the moment is something which is taking place in the academic publishing sphere, which is the move and the push to publish more research open access.
Okay, yeah.
So that's been a really big movement. It's a very important one. It's understandable. And that's a challenge for Nature because we are a subscription product. And so we've got to work out how to meet the demands of scientists and you know, the broader society who want to see those results made open access while still allowing us to kind of support our organisation. Because Nature basically argues that we add incredible value in the kind of editorial process. We, you know, have a big team of expert editors who will be involved in peer reviewing many, many more papers than we eventually publish. So we add a lot of value in that. And so how do we allow ourselves to continue that and to, you know, add that kind of quality and value if actually a lot of what you're publishing at the end, it has to be free.
Yeah.
So that's a massive conversation that is happening. We take it very seriously. We need to work out how to, you know, potentially put Nature on a road to open access.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very big challenge that we're facing. We've got to face up to, and I think we will.
And then just as a final question, we ask all our guests, what would be the last piece of media you read, watched, listened to, in, you know, in any format that you really, really loved or even hated and really want to recommend to our audience?
Yep. I thought about this because I knew you were going to ask me. I don't normally recommend TED Talks.
Yeah.
I have actually done a TED Talk, which is why I've never been able to watch it. Because it's hard to see yourself. But I did, after that, have the good fortune to go to another TED summit. Mm. And I would recommend this talk by Carol Cadwalader, who's a Guardian journalist, who gave this amazing talk, which was all about, you know, all about the way that basically social media is able to manipulate elections.
Mm.
And for me anyway, you know, sometimes that you can't quite wrap your head, like, how that's happening. What are other people seeing on social media that you're not seeing, which is allowing that to happen? And
yeah.
I thought her talk did an amazing job of showing exactly how that could have worked, or, you know, did work in the vote for Britain to leave the European Union, which, of course, we're living and breathing the consequences of still today. So I found that really inspiring.
So, people, we have a newsletter. We've mentioned it once or twice before. However, we're thinking, maybe we're going to change the newsletter. And in thinking about that, we've decided to ask you, our lovely listeners, what you would like to see from the Media Voices newsletter. Do you want it to be longer? Do you want it to be shorter? Do you want it to come out more frequently? Do you want pictures of cats or baby sheep? I don't know. So we want to put a survey out, hopefully Monday, but certainly next week, and you can tell us what you want from a newsletter. But in the meantime, sign up for the Fecan newsletter.
You can also follow us during the week by going to our Twitter feed, which is at Media Voices Pod. Or if you want to browse through our archives or check out the latest episode, you can go to the website, which is voices.media.
And all our writing is now up to date as well.
That's good.
And as we mentioned at the start, the Publisher Podcast Awards are open for less than 2 weeks. So if you're a publisher with a podcast, gosh, so many podcasts and publishers, go to publisherpodcastawards.com for more and for the entry pack, or follow us on Twitter at PubPodAwards.
But until next week, when we're going to be back with a fantastic guest, a wry look at the news and views from around the media world, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.